for a new adventure in terror. Live through the wild bloodbath of the Slime People. With lust they come, with vengeance and murder. See the nightmare of the Slime People.
Do you care?
No.
Bonnie? Maybe I shouldn't have done that.
I don't know. I think I kind of liked it.
I want you to know one thing, though. I'm not the kind of guy that just goes around kissing any girl.
I know.
I'm glad because... Well, when we get out of here, I want to see a lot more of you. But right now, I've got a job to do.
I know.
Gee whiz. You know, as long as you're sitting here, I don't even want to think about slime people.
Okay. Are we rolling? Good. Forgotten Horrors Podcast, take one. Do the appropriate music. No. I said the appropriate music. That's more like it. This is Mike Price welcoming you to the Forgotten Horrors Podcast, a blatant exploitation of our new series of Forgotten Horrors movie books. It is my pleasure now to introduce John Woolley, without whom none of this would be possible. And now, the acclaimed author of Soul Soup for the Chickens and others too humorous to mention, John Woolley.
And ladies and gentlemen, if you've been listening to the podcast, you know that voice belongs to Michael H. Price, the co-originator and the man who is continuing the Forgotten Horrors series of movie reference books. I guess probably the longest running series of
books. We've been in print continuously since 1979.
Nice. Very nice.
Yeah.
And we've got a new one out that I was privileged to be a part of, which we'll talk about after we talk about our film.
Right, yeah, Volume 9.
And so our film for tonight, Michael, is, it stars a guy who is prominently featured in Forgotten Horrors 9.
And
that's our friend Bill Boyce.
Good old Bill Boyce.
And what we're talking about tonight is a film called The Slime People.
I couldn't tell you the exact quote offhand, but one of the characters said, well, I just don't want to hear anything more about the slime people.
That's right. That's right. And Bill says at one point when he's romancing Judy Morton's character, says, golly, when I'm with you, I forget all about the slime people. It was done by Joseph Robertson, who also did The Crawling Hand, and then later on kind of got off into the skin flick business. Written by him and his wife, Blair, Robertson took the nom de plume, or the nom de script, of Vance Skarstedt.
It works. It's a picture. You cut yourself a big old slice of key slime pie and sit back with a fresh Corona with lime or
That's
slime.
Right, slime.
I love that new ad campaign Corona is doing. Their new slogan is, and you got to be. I wish the announcer were more careful, but it's unintentionally funny. You know, you're supposed to drink a Corona with a slice of lime.
Right.
And at a certain point in the commercial, the announcer says, every Corona gets its slime. It's like, couldn't you have worded that a little more carefully?
And now when I see those ads, I'm going to think immediately back to Joseph Robertson's Slime People.
Yeah.
Robert Hutton is actually the big name in it. He allegedly directed it. And I think in one of Tom Weaver's books, he talked about directing it. Bill Boyce, however, who was a friend of ours, and he was in a movie made by, well, he was in several movies, but he was in a movie that I made and a movie that Joey made because he was from around this area, and he was a friend and one of the sweetest men that you would ever meet. He claims that Joseph Robertson directed most of this picture. and that that in fact Robert Hutton was kind of a prima donna and wouldn't do the stunts. Now, Bill did a lot of stunts. If you watch the Slime People, even through that hideous mass of fog that they have in the picture, and I don't even think, I mean, you know, Edgar Ulmer in his pictures, like Man from Planet X, would use fog to obscure the cheapness of the sets. I'm not sure that's what's happening here.
I think they just lost control of their fog machine.
It may be that simple. It does look like it because they're outdoor scenes that they're using. They're shooting on location, and I don't think that they're trying to cover anything up. But boy, did you have the problem that Joey and I did with this?
It's an incredibly dense looking picture, and not because of the art direction or the cinematography.
Right.
It's all like, what are they, you know, it's like, somebody turn off the fog machine. It's like too much echo on a Jerry Lee Lewis record.
Exactly. Yeah. Rechanneled for stereo. Right.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But yeah, it takes away from the action, because some of the action that's obscured by the fog is some pretty good stunt work by Bill and the Slime People.
You can tell that Boyce in particular is just really putting heart and soul into this.
Yes, he absolutely is.
I doubt it made him much money.
No.
I think he probably, well, as he makes pretty plain in your documentary film, he generally worked for the sake of working.
Yes, he did.
But there's something, everything I've ever seen him and heard him do as a recording artist, it's just like he really throws himself into it.
He does. He really does. And he's got that kind of oaky deal, and it really is a Texas deal as well, of sort of being self-deprecating, I guess. But that doesn't in any way cover up what he does and what he wanted to do. He had a huge ambition to be a star.
He's another Clue Gulager.
Yes. Yes.
That same kind of real personality that informs everything. Most of what I've seen out of Bill, he's really making more of his part than was written for him to play.
Right. I agree. And he, you know, he had like a lot of actors and stuff. He had some close calls with, he thought he was getting the Jethro Bodine part in the Beverly Hillbillies. Was shot out of the saddle at the very last minute by Max Baer Jr. and the people behind Max Baer Jr. But the rest of the cast here is pretty interesting. You know, Robert Hutton, I had forgotten he was in Hollywood Canteen.
Remember that? He had a career, went way back into the, how far back? I know at the very least to 1940. Well, wartime.
World War II.
Yeah,
Hollywood Canteen's 44.
Sure.
And so the
career arc is quite fascinating. It did a lot of early and even into the well-established period. Worked on a good TV version of The Whistler, the old radio and Columbia B movie series. Mm-hmm. And you see him show up in, he's in William, not Billy, William Wilder's Nostradamus movie, The Man Without a Body.
Right.
And he's, kind of a mad doctor type.
Yeah.
And so he really, really had an extensive career. Colossus of New York. He's one of the eggheads and Invisible Invaders.
Yeah. Later on, Tales from the Crypt.
And Tales from the Crypt. I think he plays Peter Cushing's annoying neighbor.
Yes, he does. That's exactly right. And Trog. He's in Trog. He's in Cry the Banshee. I mean, he did all those. But he was also a Warner Brothers contract player. You know.
Oh, yeah.
And for many years. Well, and then you've got Susan Hart, we've got Robert Burton, who's the dad of Susan Hart and Judy Morton's characters. He'd been around the block, too, you know. He's a very solid old character actor. But, you know, most of Susan Hart's publicity said that her first co-starring role was in Ride the Wild Surf. And she's very good in that. I mean, I love Ride the Wild Surf, but that was after The Slime People. And she had actually, I read some things where she had actually, in some interviews, never even acknowledged that she was in the Slime People. This was before she'd married James Nicholson. And,
right.
of course, became an AIP person then, because Nicholson being the co-owner of American International Pictures.
Corporate but, royalty, yeah.
Right. She married him in August of 64, and this was like a year or something before that happened. But there's a lot of very familiar faces in this. And one of the interesting things is that Judy Morton, who plays Bill Boyce's girlfriend, and there's about, gosh, I can't remember how many years between them, but Bill is a lot older. I think he's 8 or 9 years older. And she was, and he told me, and I think I've got it in the story in Forgotten Horrors 9, but he told me that he mentioned her to Joseph Robertson because they were both from Shawnee, Oklahoma.
Oh, for goodness sake.
Yeah. And he says, I don't know if that had anything to do with it or not, but here, what are the chances that the secondary roles, the two ingenue roles, would both be from a small town in Oklahoma? Shawnee. I mean, that seems very strange to me. Now, one of the things that happens, I think, is you get this sort of mixed up with The Crawling Hand, because that was a Robertson picture as well, of course.
Right.
And there's a young medical student in it who's played by someone you interviewed, Rod Lauren.
Rod Lauren.
Someone who. A lot of people tried to make him into a teen star, but the public resisted. And he plays kind of the Bill Boyce character in The Crawling Hand. Both of those pictures were released about the same time. Bill told me that Richard Arlen, the old Hollywood actor, had a lot to do with getting the money for The Slime People. Richard Arlen is actually in The Crawling Hand. So he was an associate, I guess, of Joseph Robertson's.
Yeah.
Do you recall if those two pictures were released? They were both released in the same month. I just wonder if they were a double bill. I don't think that something tells me that they weren't. But do you have any?
No, they weren't. And you know, I never saw a theatrical presentation of The Slime People.
Oh, you never did.
Okay. That's not to say it didn't play, but it certainly didn't play in my market, where I was just like looking up every picture of this nature I could get my mitts on.
Right.
And that would, you know, I first saw The Crawling Hand, by contrast, at a drive-in theater down the street from my parents' house.
Oh, sign that was, they were both released by the same company as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
By Robertson's company. Huh. Hansen International or whatever that was called, Hansen Pictures, whatever that was called.
I believe that's right. Mm-hmm. I think I've got a set of notes. Yes, Donald Hansen. Mm-hmm. Donald Hansen Enterprises.
Okay. And we haven't not mentioned, the only person we haven't mentioned is probably the biggest vet of them all, and that's Les Tremaine.
Oh, yeah.
Who shows up as a very weird drunken doctor carrying a goat in the picture. And I guess we should, usually by this time we've done, I'll do a quick rundown. Essentially, these are just creatures that live under the ground that have been jarred loose and are coming to the top because of underground nuclear testing. And so they're taking over Los Angeles, and there's a small group of people, Bill Boyce and Judy Morton and Robert Burton and the lead character whose name I just lost, not Robert Burton, but
Robert
Hutton, of course.
Robert Hutton.
And Susan Hart.
The purported director and star, yeah.
Right, yes. And so it's, and Joey mentioned this, our producer, Joey Hamburg, he mentioned that this has got a kind of a Night of the Living Dead vibe to it.
Oh, yeah.
This small group of people menaced by, you know, these forces from outside that they've just never dealt with before.
Yeah, kind of like an outdoor alien or something is stalking.
Right.
And of course, they might as well be in a confined space with all that fog.
They sure might as well be. What do you suppose was the reason for that, honestly, Michael?
Wow. I really do think it was an unintentional overkill.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't imagine there were too many retakes.
And there really wasn't. Oh no, no, they're an unaffordable commodity.
Right.
And there really isn't a lot of authorship apparent in this picture.
Mm-hmm. Expand on that if you would.
You don't get the sense of seeing a director at work. I don't really believe in the so-called auteur theory, where a collaborative project is judged to be primarily the work of one visionary person, a director or a writer, maybe a producer. If the auteur theory has any validity in American B movies, it would probably be somebody like William Castle,
perhaps, or Sam Fuller,
Sam Fuller, guys who left their thumbprints all over any picture they did.
Yes.
You look at a picture from this very same period, a little Roger Corman throwaway called Dementia 13.
Oh, yes. And one of my favorites.
Oh, yeah. It's like Corman was trying to do an imitation William Castle movie.
Mm-hmm. And Castle was trying to do imitation Alfred Hitchcock.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
So it's like Mamie Van Doren to Jane Mansfield to Marilyn Monroe.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
So here's what happens. They throw. It was kind of like Corman had done The Terror with Boris Karloff and Jack Nicholson.
Mm-hmm.
They had sets left over. They had time left over on their players' contracts
from Young Racers, if I remember right.
From the Young Racers, in the case of Dementia 13, and so here's this kid named Francis Coppola, who's kind of working as a flunky gopher for Corman.
I think he did sound or something on Young Racers, maybe, or something.
He'd been in a technical capacity there, kind of like Bill Paxton was on the later Cormans before he broke out. And, hey, kid, you want to bang out this script, and we'll call it Dementia 13, also known as The Haunter and the Haunters and the Haunted. And Coppola bangs the script out in short order with some collaborative help and gets to direct. I mean, it's like Corman looks at it as a throwaway. Coppola looks at it as an opportunity.
Yes.
And you go back and look at the early reviews. I forget which publication it was that made this declaration. It says one clearly sees the hand of a director at work here. And that's
a vision, in other words, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. That's what distinguishes a picture like Coppola weighed in with on Dementia 13, and what a kind of a, you know, The Slime People might as well have been an orphaned picture. It just happened.
Well, perhaps that's because Hutton did some of it and Robertson did some of it. And I remember Bill telling me, we had lots of conversations. I remember Bill telling me that he did a lot of, you know, kind of directing the I guess second unit would what it would be, because he did a lot of the stunts. Nothing to do with the stunts.
Stuntman, stunt coordinator is always your best second unit director.
Right, exactly. Well, one of the things they do in this picture is give the monster away about, 15 seconds in or something? And that was one of the things when I was a monster kid, that was one of the things I absolutely hated.
Yep.
I wanted to see the monster. I didn't want them to give the monster away immediately. I wanted to see that monster later on when they'd built it up a little bit with some shucking and jiving.
Anticipation. Well, you know, even the great Roger Corman was guilty of that.
He was.
But George Turner and I were watching The Slime People, George being the co-inventor of Forgotten Horrors.
Yes.
We were watching The Slime People on TV one afternoon during the 1970s, and he notes that early giveaway, and you'd think they'd have better sense than to show their damn monster strolling around like he was at a Sunday school picnic.
Exactly.
And it's not a very good-looking monster at that.
It's not a very good-looking monster.
Kind of looks like a beached grouper.
It does. It absolutely does. And, you know, all I can say, I think there were, you know, I've heard wildly varying estimates of how many Seuss there actually were. We were watching it the other night, and it looks to me like the most you ever see together of the Slime People are three.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect, you know, that that was probably about right. About three slime people were in there. But, you know, Bill is so earnest. He's not a great actor in this by any stretch of the imagination. That, you know, when they first, he plays a Marine that's been, you know, that's lost his company. And at that first line, "Am I glad to see you people?" Great Bill Boyce line, and he told me once, he said, well, he said, you know, you just pretend like you did when you were a kid playing cowboys and Indians. He said, that's what I did in Slime People. He was very proud of Slime People. He was very proud of it. And, you know, he's way down in the credits, but in some ways it's kind of his picture.
Well, he's the memorable personality. Yes. Poor old Tremaine is just walking through the park. A guy like Hutton, like Tremaine, they were slumming.
Yeah.
They knew it. A guy like Boyce, you know, it's an opportunity.
Well, and Judy Morton and Susan Hart, I would say, as well.
Exactly. Yeah, and so they're throwing more into it, as I said earlier, than either the screenplay provides them with material for, or really more effort than they're getting paid to do.
Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah. They're trying very hard on this, and I really wish that it had led to something more for Bill. But then Bill ended up in commercials and was the Marlboro Man and all this kind of stuff. And as you alluded to earlier, I mean, he was a money actor. He was wanted to make money, and because he came from a very poor background, farming background in Oklahoma. And but when all was said and done, he was very proud of the studio stuff that he did, the Slime People, and especially, which he, to his dying days, called a science fiction classic. It's not a classic, but I think it's pretty watchable. What's your estimation of it?
A classic, that designation doesn't really signify quality that much, is it? Not quite so much as it signifies definitive of its kind.
Right. Well,
and it may be the only film of its kind. So.
Well, exactly. So there you have it. That's right. I would recommend it. I think it's a very watchable and interesting film in a lot of ways. Again,
no, I wouldn't trade for the experience. It's and not that I've gone back and watched it over and over. You get a refresher screening once in a while, like on this occasion. Mm-hmm. But you remember it fondly, not as a picture that would change your life or make you make you feel like you needed to immediately rewind and see it again.
Right. No.
But
exactly.
But certainly the kind of picture that stays with you, as some people probably would take it as an object of ridicule.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people would take it as just like, what do I want to watch that crap for?
Mm-hmm.
And you go to a picture like this with the right attitude, and you're going to be glad you watched it.
That's right. That's exactly right. And I remember when we were shooting Bill Boyce Money Actor, which we're going to talk about here in just a little bit, the documentary that Leo Evans and I did on Bill. And as soon as we were done shooting that day, we had several, well, they were kids. They were all Joey's age at that time.
Yeah.
My boys and some of their friends, including Joey, they were all probably, well, in 2007, how old were you, Joey? How old would you have been in 2000?
I think it was before 2007.
Yeah. Maybe 2006, you know, something like that. So you were like a teenager, maybe, or 20.
Early
20s. And I brought the guys back that had been doing the thing with Bill, and we sat in my living room and watched the Slime People so they could see what he looked like, you know, 40 years before.
Right.
I think everyone enjoyed it. They were kind of stunned that Bill had done this. And, you know, so there you go. And speaking of that, we want to say, as we move into our plugs for this evening or for this podcast, that Bill Boyce Money Actor, the documentary, which is about 35 minutes long, that we did in 2007, thanks to our producer, Joey Hambrick, has found its way to Amazon, and it's streaming on Amazon, and you can check it out if you'd like to know more about Bill Boyce. It's on Amazon streaming. Am I saying that right, Joey? Streaming?
Yes.
Okay, good. Thank you. All right. And so if you'd like to know more about Bill Boyce, check that out. And I may say, If you'd like to read more about Bill Boyce, Michael, you were kind enough to indulge me and let me write my personal reminiscence of Bill in Forgotten Horrors number 9, which is just now on sale, and it's really doing well. I've noticed on Amazon, it's doing well.
The book is a perfect vehicle for that sort of the kind of writing and the kind of storytelling that you're not going to find anywhere else.
Right.
Mainly because books don't exist that indulge that sort of interest.
Yeah, there's that.
And
I would say all the Forgotten Horrors books are like that, honestly.
That's what we aim to do, because I know there are readers who love to read about things that aren't considered mainstream enough to warrant publication.
Yes.
That's why when you see the latest genre article in, say, an issue of Entertainment Weekly, heaven forbid, you automatically know that they're cribbing from some scholar.
Right. Or some fanboy, as it were.
Yeah, or fan, or somebody who doesn't enjoy the corporate exposure that an issue of, you know, Entertainment Weekly, save me from that garbage, because they crib. I wouldn't jump to say outright plagiarism, but you know they didn't. The people in the mainstream publications are not interested enough in genre exercises to bother to do their homework.
Right, right.
So they're going to find, you know, they're going to look up an issue of a magazine like Film Facts or maybe Scary Monsters, and they're going to glean the cream of the information, and they're going to put that under their own byline in a mock authoritative voice. Forgotten Horrors, you know, not to blow one's own horn too much, but
no, go right ahead.
Hey,
you're among friends here.
We know our onions.
Well,
and we don't care who knows that.
I'll tell you, and let me get around. Speaking of not wanting to blow one's own horn, I was involved with Ed Hulse and Doug Ellis in a new book called The Art of the Pulps.
Oh,
and it's actually become a bestseller on Amazon, which is very nice. But what they did was commission several people who are experts in different pulp magazine genres to write about those genres. So Michelle Nolan did romance. I did detective. There were many others that really did. David Saunders, who's Norman Saunders, the artist's son, worked on it. And one of the reviews that came in said, these are not fan exercises, which is what people would expect from something like, and the reason I even mentioned that, they would expect that from something like Forgotten Horrors 9. And what you do in the Forgotten Horrors books is fan topics. In other words, as you said, obscure films that haven't been perhaps hashed over very much, but instead of approaching them from a fanish basis, you approach them as a real writer, as a real journalist. And that's the thing that I've always, because both you and I are old newspaper writers for years, and, you know, we know how to do that sort of thing. And the people you get know how to do that sort of thing. So that's the thing I really like about it. It's those topics, but it's not fan writing. It's approaching them with, I'm not going to say reverence, but we're not snarky, certainly. That's one of the things you and I both.
Well, you can't. You too much reverence is like too much ridicule.
That's right.
You can. It's important to maintain critical thinking, but it's more important to maintain ethically based critical thinking.
Yes, that's right.
And that's, you know, when George Turner and I set out to do that first Forgotten Horrors book in the mid-70s, George had just published a comprehensive study called The Making of King Kong. I was, you know, like thrilled that he should invite me to do this collaborative study of low-budget horror movies. The reason we chose the genre was because we felt it had been severely neglected. One of the most popular capsule movie review books was a thing written by Stephen Schur of TV Key magazine in New York, and you know, I picked it up eagerly when it, as a schoolboy, and got to thumbing through it. And, let me see what this big important journalist has to say about one of my favorite movies. So I pulled up Bride of Frankenstein, and here's Stephen Schur wrote, "Way above average for this kind of trash."
Wow.
And it's like, okay,
right,
okay.
Right, right. And, you know, the thing about it is, though, we talk about how we approach it, but let's also not forget that we do approach it with that sense of wonder, too.
Oh, yeah. Well, if you lose your sense of wonder, you might as well just cash it in.
The rest of it is not, then, you know, the cynicism kicks in and everything else, and it's not, I mean, it's just... These films, it's really Robert Louis Stevenson, isn't it? I mean, the world is so full of a number of things, and we should all be as happy as kings. And I really believe that about these pictures. And when we can look at an old picture, and I'm sure the people listening to us feel exactly the same way, when even though in this digital age, it's hard to make discoveries, a lot harder than it used to be. Still, when you discover a film that you haven't seen that you love, and it's still that wonder and that joy is still there, I think.
I would like to believe that will be perpetual.
I would hope so. Certainly is with you and me, I think, and
yeah.
with Joey, too, I suspect. What else have you got to plug for the holidays? Now we're moving into the holidays, and I've got one more thing I'd like to talk briefly about. What about you?
Oh golly, I'm pretty keen on plugging the heck out of our comic book anthology, Deep in the Horrors of Texas.
Yes, I was happy to be a little part of that too. Not as big as Forgotten Horrors 9, but I was happy to be a part of that. Yeah,
that's a delight in itself, and some original stories, that have never appeared anywhere else, and some rediscoveries, and like your excellent Barbarian Morning, which is like, well, where did that take place? Could have been in Texas, because that's where that barbarian guy came from in the first place.
Right.
Not to mention any names, you know.
Yeah, right. I remember visiting Robert E. Howard's home. With when my children were very young.
West of where I live, yeah.
Yes, in the Cross Plains.
Yeah.
And at this time, it was before it had really been, I don't know what it's like now, but it was, you know, when you wanted to see it, well, somebody downtown at the Robert E. Howard Museum or at the library down there just gotten her pickup and led you out there. And I had told my boys were probably, 14 and 11 or something, and my younger boy has always been the pragmatist, and so I had explained to them about Robert E. Howard. I had them read a couple of Robert E. Howard stories, and so we were out there, and Stephen, with the directness that kids have, my younger boy said to the woman, said, well, now where exactly did he shoot himself? And the woman said, right about where you're standing.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So, but anyway, I would like to mention our Hard-Boiled Christmas Stories, which seems to be a kind of a perennial nice seller for us. I have a little press with John McMahon called Reverse Karma Press, which of course you named because of your idea of reverse karma, the idea that we dig up all these old people because at some point or another we may want to be dug up ourselves at some point later on in the future. But Reverse Karma Press published Hardboiled Christmas Stories, and it's all pulp stories plus a new story I wrote in the style of Robert Leslie Bellum's Dan Turner Hollywood Detective, and they're all set in the Yuletide season. We've got Steve Fisher, who wrote I Wake Up Screaming, and many, many others in that collection. And that's for the hard to buy for reader on your Christmas list. We'd like to recommend that. And all of these books are available on Amazon.com, of course.
Yeah.
Well, next time we're going to do something with John Hoyt. Now, a lot of folks know John Hoyt. I'm sure a lot of the listeners know John Hoyt. Very reliable presence in any number of low-budget movies. I saw The Time Travelers the other day. He's got a nice part in that. Attack of the Puppet People. He's the puppet master in that Bird Eye Gordon picture. I just watched a film called Lone Shark, one of those Lippert films where Robert Lippert picked up a lot of the stars who were really freelancing looking for work after the studios started getting shit of their contract players. And he is wonderful in that picture. He blows everybody out of the water. Well, this is a picture I believe that he wrote. I know he stars in it. Psychological horror picture, which has been known as a number of titles. One is Bed of Fire, but I think probably most people know it as The Glass Cage. Came out in the early 1960s.
Sure.
Do you know the picture?
Yes, but it's been years.
Well, we're going to have a fresh, just a good excuse to have a fresh look at it, Mark.
That's a wonderful thing.
I think it is a wonderful thing. Meanwhile, we encourage you, if you'd like it, with Christmas coming on, we would love to see you take a look at some of the Forgotten Horrors titles. They're all available on Amazon as well as Hardboiled Christmas Stories, and also take a look streaming at Bill Boyce Money Actor. And those are our plugs for tonight. And I think that's it, Michael. Anything else we need to do before we sign off?
I think we've covered the waterfront.
I think we have indeed. Thank you so much, and thanks, folks, for listening. We appreciate it. We'll be back before you know it.